Well, first of all, a big thank you to the Mosaic Rooms for inviting us, and an equally big thank you to all of you for being so gracious to come. It's really, really excellent. I'm just going to start by saying a few things about the book before we actually start talking about the book. I'm going to say a little bit about me, for those of you who don't know me, and therefore the origins of the book. A little bit about the context, the political context in which the book evolved. It was not a book I meant to write. And then I want to talk about the kind of steep learning curve that I found in Britain when I entered an unknown part of Britain. And at the same time, as part of the context, I have to tell you something about what's happened in America over the 10 years, which is really the years of this book. So, first thing, me. I'm a journalist, and for much of my life I've been a war correspondent. And the way I learnt to be a war correspondent, from Vietnam to many places in Africa, was I learnt that to get the texture of the war, you had to listen to the people affected by the war. It was not okay to be going to briefings and being told by the people who were making the war what was happening. So when the American declared war on terror began, I thought it was important to understand it and see it from the point of view of its origins, which is really in the American funding of a holy war in Afghanistan in order to destroy the Soviet Union. And I just want to read you one quote which I think totally sums that up. It's Brzezinski, who described it as calling the USSR its Vietnam War. And this was when they began the secret funding of the Mujahideen. And about 20 years later, he was interviewed by a journalist in Paris who asked him, had it been such a good idea? And he said, what is more important to the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War? So I think that's a kind of important bit of context to what happened over this this period. And of course, one strand of the people who went to fight in this war in Afghanistan was Palestine. Many of the people who went were either refugees from 48 or from 67, and many of them took their families. And one strand of this book is, again, it took me by surprise, is how many of the families that I write about, the women that I write about, are Palestinian. And that also is the case of the cases in America. So Palestine is very big in this. So that's enough about me and the context immediately. But the origins of the book really come from 2004, I was asked by the Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn if I would be the interviewer for a number of families in Britain who had family members in Guantanamo Bay. And at that point, you remember 2004, nobody knew anything about these families. We just saw a few sort of headlines like the Tipton Taliban and a few slogans like that. But really, nobody knew anything about them. And the administrator of the Tricycle at the time, Nick Kent, made a kind of alliance with the lawyers for many of these families, and they agreed that doing a play that was verbatim, controlled by them, their words, would be a way of showing people, what is this Guantanamo Bay, and what is its relation to our society here? So as a result of that, I became very, very friendly with the father of Mohsen Beg, who was, of course, in Guantanamo Bay. And the reason that Mr. Beg, I think, liked me so much was partly because of my name and partly because I'd been born in India, as had he. And he had a whole kind of Raj image of Britain in his mind, which had been completely shattered by the fact that his son had been kidnapped by Americans and had apparently ended up in prison. And nobody in the authority in Britain was doing anything about it. This was a real disconnect. So somehow we became allies and friends. So when Mohsen came out of Guantanamo Bay, it wasn't altogether surprising that he asked me to help him write his memoir, Enemy Combatant. And through Mohsen, I met other men who came back from Guantanamo Bay, because he lived at my house for 8 months while we wrote this book. And as the months went on, those men and other men who were differently victims of the war on terror began to ask me to visit their wives. So by all those chances, I started on a kind of 10-year journey, which was a very steep learning curve for me, very steep learning curve. And these are some of the things I found in Britain that 10 years ago, 11 years ago in some cases, completely, rather like Mr. Begg and his idea of, oh, Britain isn't what I thought it was. I slightly had the same reaction. And of course, I'd lived abroad a lot, so I did not have a profound idea of Britain except as the place where I had basically been brought up. So when I found detention without trial was going on, and this was considered completely normal and nobody was talking about it, when I found there were people living under house arrest in Britain, I began to find this another world. And as I spent time in these families, I encountered the racism and Islamophobia of police officers, health visitors, immigration officials, and a lot of petty racism and Islamophobia, like snatching off veils when we were in the park and things like that, which I would never have expected to be knowing about. And the texture of these lives that I was seeing, that was what was happening in Britain, I found profoundly shaming as a British person. And I found that I'd entered into a kind of village where friendship with one woman brought friendship with others. And gradually, all the women who are in this book had either their husbands had asked me to approach them or they had approached me. And there were a lot of other women who wanted to be in the book when I actually came to do it. But I only chose very carefully the ones that I did. And I don't want you to think I am a journalist, but it's not a journalist book in that I didn't set out to interview them or anything like that. The book grew out of friendship and listening and playing with kids, doing homework and living a life. And I only did it. In fact, I did this first because at one point, some of them said to me, you know, you're supposed to be a writer. How come you don't write about us? And because of the culture of reticence, which is so important to them, and privacy and all of that, I couldn't think how to do it. So what I thought of doing was to write this play, The Meaning of Waiting, also available in Arrow. And I only used their words. And interestingly, what happened with the play was it went to lots of artistic directors of theatres, and I kept getting back no's. Sometimes I got, no, Victoria, too many women, they're all women. And sometimes I got, oh, Victoria, no, no, they're all foreigners, too many foreigners. And then often I got women, foreigners, married to terrorists, are you joking? Anyway, it did get put on. briefly at the South Bank a couple of times, and a couple of you here came, and thank you for that. But that wasn't enough for them, because several of the women came. There was a fantastic first night when many of them came, and there were these slightly hilarious scenes of them embracing the actresses afterwards, saying, and some of them don't speak such brilliant English, but also you had the daughters translating the English back into Arabic, which they had originally translated from Arabic into English for me. But anyway, after that, they were all fired up and said, play, play, let's have a book, let's have a book. So that's how the book kind of came about. But at the same time, as I was having, on the one hand, this very sad experience, on the other hand, this very rich experience of friendship and new culture and so on, because I'm a journalist and the war on terror was the biggest thing going on, I was watching very carefully what was happening in America, and I saw the evolution of a new America, an America in which torture was authorized by the most senior people in the country. A country in which the whole judicial system was completely perverted and politicized, so that every time there was a court case that on these kind of cases could they be tried, every time the court case was won, a higher judge, a more political judge, would knock it back. And that spread of the new America that was going on, and the lawlessness, the decision to do away with the Geneva Conventions, invent something called enemy combatant, allow people to be held in Guantanamo Bay for weeks, months, years, and now more than a decade, was a new America. But the counterpart to that, and it's a very important theme in my book and a source of my book, was the American lawyers who fought against this. And I think their names and the contribution they've made in trying to keep our civilization something like it was before you had all of this is of course, it's not an untold story, because people have written enormous fat academic books about all of that. But I set out to write something different. And the main thing for me was I had to be true to my friends. And I don't know if any of you heard the last British resident in Guantanamo Bay, a Saudi called Shaka Arma. His wife is chapter 2 in my book. He could be heard on a CBS news program, where they, CBS being powerful, were allowed a tour of Guantanamo Bay. And while the reporter was having the tour past all these closed doors, you suddenly hear this voice which says, tell the world the truth. Tell them what it's like to be shackled like an animal. And it was Shaka. And when he said that thing about tell the world the truth, I had another of those moments of thinking, I'm so glad we decided to do this book, because it is the women's truth. And what it tells you about what happened to their husbands, as well as how they lived through that period and how their children have lived through that period, is true. I know it's true because I was there. Everything in the book is what I saw. So, Haifa.
I think 3/4 what I wanted to discuss with you has already been mentioned. So, you talk about the woman, and actually, I was thinking maybe there should be more space for their own words. But after reading what you've written, I was worried a bit. I mean, here is the journalist who is going to tell the story on behalf of other people. So, quoting from time to time, what is very highly selective, probably. I mean, that's what happens usually with journalists. But I read it. I read every single story. I read the whole book from cover to cover. And it is really a genuine, truthful. I mean, that's what strikes you to start with. You have this feeling while you're reading it, and you can tell. these are the women you were friendly with. They welcomed you in their houses. That and their houses weren't open to everybody. They are from families that they are really living almost like enclosed, especially after what the husbands went through and after the harassment of the police and the investigations and the raids on their houses at any time. So this is, and also it's a world where the legal system is blurred with legalizing the illegal, almost. And it's happening in America, it's happening in Britain, where democracy is supposedly to be. The irony is, these are the two countries that they are selling democracy to the rest of the world. So who is the buyer anymore? I mean, shouldn't we worry about it? So this is it. But what I would like to know, I mean, what's happening to the women now? It's been written like over a year now, or the book being published over a year. And also I've noticed there are changes in the laws. It's been mentioned in a couple of places. Liberty, for example, there is about the control orders, there is a change. What is it beneficial for those women? Touching their children, going to schools, escaping like this strict restrictions of movement. One girl, the kids, they can't get an access to the internet. Nowadays, 5 years old kids have internet, access to internet and computers and all. So they consider it an achievement if one girl getting the computer, and after providing that her father, who is housebound, he can't reach the upstairs room in his wheelchair, so he got access. This is the most cruel, brutal system on daily life, to be imprisoned in your own place, in your house. So are there any changes?
Well, and let me, in case people aren't familiar with house arrest as we have it in Britain, there used to be something called control orders. Control orders was invented by the government of Tony Blair after a dozen Arab and Algerian men had been interned without trial and kept in Belmarsh prison for 2.5 years. Finally, the House of Lords ruled that this was illegal. They had to be released. They were not accused of anything. They were just thought to be somehow not conducive to the welfare of Britain. So this system of control orders was invented, which was a house arrest, as Haifa says, which was so draconian that nobody can visit you in that house without getting permission from the intelligence services. And not everybody wants to be investigated by the intelligence services, so not surprisingly they didn't have so many visitors. And then there were all these rules, like they couldn't use internet, they couldn't have internet at home. So everybody in the family was effectively under house arrest. Then there have been many, many legal challenges to the conditions, and some of them have slowly got slightly improved. But recently, Theresa May just changed the name. It's now called Terrorism Prevention Something Methods, TPIMS for short. Yeah, yeah. It's actually more or less, ask anyone who's on one. Mm. It's the same as when they were on a control order. So that's the answer is yes. But it's changed in the sense that now they use TPIMS for all kinds of British people. As well, but when they were originally, they were they were exclusively for this small group of people who were in this kind of small village that I'm writing about. You're asking me what's happened to them since. Yes. I stopped writing this book a year ago.
Yes.
And what's happened since then? Well, as their lawyer Gareth Pearce has often said, there are no happy endings in these stories. Three of them have left the country, and they left the country because our government, made it impossible really for them to stay here. And a combination of the petty and less petty cruelties that I've described had made their lives completely intolerable. So that's the three of them. But there is one happy ending. There's one happy ending, which is Josephine, whose husband was on a control order and who made several suicide attempts. She had a very, very hard time. But Josephine was always the most... she's French, expansive, cheerful, amazing person. And I want to just tell you one little story, if I may, about when I first met her. I hadn't yet got clearance to enter the house, and I phoned her to say I'd applied for clearance. Oh, she said, don't bother about applying for clearance. Come and see me anyway. And she told me the tube station somewhere in East London. I said, how will we recognise each other? She said, oh, you'll recognise me. And sure enough, this extremely tall person, niqab, gloves, the whole everything, came zooming up the pavement towards me, embracing me as though we were kind of childhood friends, took me back to her house, took a chair and put it on the pavement outside for me to sit on, and she sat inside the house. And she put another chair for the coffee, and she's meanwhile playing with her baby. Midwinter, we were in heavy coats. And she carried on as though it was the most relaxed meeting anybody could possibly have. And she was telling me stories about her husband and men, you know, it's a tassel and, you know, all this kind of thing. It was the most extraordinary kind of manifestation of resilience and humour and everything. Anyway, Josephine, whose story is actually the only funny part really in this book, because many funny stories, her husband finally won a court order to have his electronic tag taken off his leg and his curfew hours to be dropped, only for 1 year. But for the first time, this family can go out and have a pizza together or go to a movie or go to the park. And after 10 years, it's such a joy to see them. But I have to go back to Zanira, Shaka's wife. This is somebody who, as she told me several years ago, her husband's been away from her now longer than they were together. Her youngest child has never met her father. And things are very, very tough for her. She's had a lot of near breakdowns, and it's a family under huge stress. And within this small world, Zanira's support comes from other women who phone her or who go round, and if ever she's in one of her bad times, there will be text messages and somebody will go there. And all of this in a completely informal way. But it's very hard as a British person spending time in a family who has been so wounded by the failure of our government. And every time I hear William Hague say, we're doing everything we can to get Shaka returned, it's not true. It can't be true. If it was a real priority for them, they would have done something dramatic. I know this is kind of an unfashionable idea, but you know, if I were William Hague, I would have gone on a public hunger strike. Shaka went on hunger strike along with half of Guantanamo Bay in February. And finally, you know, the American media began to wake up, and the New York Times was calling for the closure of Guantanamo, and senators began to call for people like Shaka, who've been actually cleared by American military intelligence, cleared twice in his case. Why aren't they coming home? You know, if our government really wanted to do that, they would make a hell of a row about it, and they haven't. So that's the saddest part of my book, that nothing for her is better, and it's worse because it's gone on for longer.
Yeah, but I mean, still, the book really is not... The women, the courageous women, are so resilient, and they coping they coping at very high expense sometimes in their health, mental health, physically, and everything. But this is the spirit we see through the book. So it's not really a book that drags you down to not do anything. It is a book which lifts you up and think, well, yes, if they can do something, I can do something. Somebody else, Victoria, did something. So this is the spirit of the whole book. And there are talks about the beautiful thing which I enjoyed. I am a novelist, so I really enjoyed the place. The places you were moving in, the houses, inside the houses, the tidiness of the rooms, the kitchen, how clean they are in various houses. Though they are very small, very basic, crowded sometimes, but you can see and your insight in giving us a picture of how in order for those women to survive the chaos outside, they have to create this system inside, this tidiness, in order to assure themselves this kind of security almost is becoming, with the minimum of decoration, with the minimum of everything. But the way they also looked after their kids, after their education, they reminded me of our countries, I mean, in Iraq and Arab countries, Middle Eastern, Islamic, how persistent, how adamant we are that kids have to achieve at school. They have, the education is the weapon for them to advance, to have better status in society and all, and they kept it going, all of them. There is one thing which I would like to ask. We often hear about, or used to hear in the last few years, though, I mean, the last couple of years, we haven't heard anything about it yet. It's about the Muslim community. They keep telling us in the media, on radio, Muslim community here, Muslim. Whenever there is an attack or a violent act or someone trying to blow up somewhere, the Muslim community is approached. We try to talk to them. But I notice while reading is many people stop visiting those women because of the fear they've been intimidated. So what's happened to the Muslim community? Have they ever been there in the first place, or they were terrorized by this laws and...
From my observation, there are so many Muslim communities in this country. And it's true that in the kind of atmosphere of fear after 9/11, people did... I mean, even their close friends would block... them from phoning them, and people became very, very, very isolated. But there are always strands within bits of the Muslim community who have been very wanting to be very supportive. And my friend Saba, who is the first person I met, and my closest friend, she's chapter one. She always says that despite all the horrible things that happened, there were always mysterious people who would emerge and leave food at her house or would put money through the door. Not that I wanted money, she was saying. So there were always people who did, but they were quite few. And, I think it's much easier for somebody who's not a Muslim to not feel that fear. I mean, now we know that everybody in the world is listened to by the National Security Agency and GCHQ and all of that. Maybe we should all be as scared as many Muslims are. But I wouldn't like it to seem as though nobody was supportive. And many people wrote letters to men in Guantanamo Bay, but then often you would get them back. And people, they just didn't deliver them. Saba, for instance, at one point her husband was given 13 letters from her after 3 years of having no letters on one day. They gave this pile of letters. and mostly were from her, but other people carried on writing. And in many of the really dramatic family crises there's been in all of these families, there's always been somebody who was ready to help. Some lawyers, one or two psychiatrists, and then people kind of very much behind the scenes. I'll give you an example. There's one family in this book who were extremely demonized, and they were constantly having police raids on their house. And at one point, the father was arrested, and in the course of the police raid, they took the children's mobile phones and their computer, their laptops. Two of the kids were in university, and one was taking important exams in school. And all of this happened in the evening of Friday. And by 9 o'clock on Monday morning, new computers and new mobile phones had been donated by three or four people who'd been phoned over the weekend. So practical help people were good at. And some people were incredibly loyal. There's one very sad person in this book. He's died now. But I don't know if anybody recognises the name Abu Rida. He was in a wheelchair, a Palestinian guy. A very, very vulnerable person who had been driven completely out of his mind by how he was made to live here. And he had two friends who drove him everywhere and were always... If his wife was having a baby, they were there. If his wife wanted to take food to somebody else who was having a baby, they were ready to drive him. He was being taken to the police station, they were there. So there's been a strand of really touching loyalty, I'm sure at a great cost to people. So it's a kind of mixed picture.
Many of the men, they had depression, and obviously, I mean, clearly why? Because of this disappointment, the despair, not knowing what's happening.
I think the not knowing.
No, not knowing.
The not knowing was so awful. Yeah, yeah. Even if you're not accused of anything, or you don't know what it is you're accused of, and if you were ever in court, it's a secret court in which whatever's against you is not even told to your lawyers. As one of the lawyers once said, you know, it's like boxing with ghosts. You know, how can you not be depressed, enraged? But still, you know, faith is an amazing thing. And people manage to keep going in a way that I've found really heroic and extraordinary. And it's not only the women. Some of the men were... There's one man I've written about in here who was in prison. Yeah, for not accused of anything, by the way, just being about to be extradited. And every day he was on the phone to his kids doing people's homework, you know, completely participating in their lives in this way. So, you know, as human beings, I felt that I was discovering these really special and heroic human beings who should have been real role models in our community and people that we could all learn from. And instead we were demonising them. The political class, aided by their friends in the media, were demonising them.
You were given the Quran by Sabah, I think.
Yes, I've got quite a collection.
In English.
Quite a collection of Quran. Some of them are in both languages.
Yeah. Did you read it?
Yes, of course. And I have a lot of very good Quran saying. In fact, I was doing an event at LSE the other night, and the person before me, who was a... I mean, everybody else was Muslim on the platform, and they were all talking about Islamophobia because it's Islamophobia Awareness Month. And they were all talking about how serious Islamophobia is in their experience. And then I said, well, without at all disagreeing or anything, I think you've painted a previous speaker. you've painted a picture of a much more passive and less less resilient community than I know. And I said, you know, whenever I talk about my book or I read from my book, at the end of the meeting, I always get three or four young, usually veiled, but not always, women who come up to me and say, you know, what can I do? How can I meet these people? How can I participate in all of this? And the guy, you know, looked really sort of skeptical. But then there was a question from the floor from another young man saying, you know, everything that I've heard today and everything I experience as a undergraduate student, Muslim, just makes me feel incredibly depressed and alienated from this society. You know, how can you help me? So I thought, Saba.
Yes.
So I said, well, you know, my friend, when her husband was in Guantanamo Bay, she always used to say to me, Allah will never give me a trial that is too heavy for me. And he looked at me like that. And it was really touching, actually. I could see him thinking, oh, it's like my granny talking. But, you know, he... And then at the end, of course, the veiled young women did come up and start talking to me and saying, you know, can you come to this event where we are organising in East London? Can you do this? Can you do that? And I could see the guys thinking, you know, what is it with these girls? They're so much more resilient than us.
Yeah.
So
and they are beyond the stereotyping.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
About stereotyping, I really enjoyed reading your portrait or
you
your. I really enjoyed reading the what you've written about Abu Qatada, because Abu Qatada, out of all the terrorists, he became like, if I borrow the words by Noor, the poster terrorists. As few hear the news, Abu Qatada, it became our problem, actually. When I'm sitting with my husband in the kitchen listening to Radio 4, I start to think, where am I going to get rid of Abu Qatada, the terrorist? So it's not just ordinary, I mean, the people, but we've been fed daily doses of Abu Qatada, the terrorist. And here he is in your book, within the family, a normal human being, who is really keen about looking about his kids, following their studies, looking at ordinary life. But this is the role, I mean, and I thought you are really courageous in a way, because you are breaking this mold of almost a steel stereotyping, which being inflicted on us on a daily basis.
Well, I mean, it's... It's a horrible thing in our society that all kinds of politicians, from Mrs. May and I think even David Cameron, couldn't stop himself talking about how relieved he will feel when Abu Qatada leaves the country. Boris Johnson, all kinds of, you know, completely unimportant backbench conservative MPs all joined in, and plenty of Labour ones, I have to say, all joined in the vilification of this man, completely forgetting this is somebody who was never tried in this country, was never even actually accused of anything in this country. Anything he was accused of in this country was so secret none of us were supposed to know about him. But actually, you know, ordinary people can sometimes be so much better than our so-called leaders. Sometimes when I used to visit him in prison, I used to notice that he was in a maximum security prison, full of kind of, you know, murderers and, you know, kind of people that you're jolly glad they're not your son as you kind of go into the visiting room. And I used to notice that the prison guards had a kind of respect for Abu Qatada when he came in. He was just on another plane from people who were criminals and who were being punished for stuff they'd done. Here was somebody who was not being punished. He was being punished for nothing that he'd done. So I think it's important to break stereotypes. And, of course, he's not the person I've written about. I've written about his gorgeous daughters, who were my darling friends. And I'm so happy that they now, when they're in Jordan, they have a normal life, whereas here they had such a life of indignity with not just the way the EDF and all these other, you know, racists would rally outside their houses and shout at them as they went to university, but the way their father was constantly demonized, and they suffered as kids, really hard time, even in their schools, things they weren't allowed to do. Was it because of my dad? Yes. But they always kept their dignity, and it's the girls that I've written about. And in one way, you know, I miss them because we used to have fun, and the mum, I loved her mum. But in another way, when I hear on the phone that they, what it's like to, after all this time, suddenly have a normal life, it's fantastic. Jordan has given them that, and our country wouldn't.
Also reminds me of, the war on terror touched on people's life, the impact of it, the horrendous impact of it, have been just not in Britain and in the UK, but also it's really the extension of it being all over the world, because they are entitled now to kidnap whoever they want, to terrorist act, and we've seen that in Iraq. One of the British citizens, Iraqi British citizens, his name is Ramzi Shahab Ahmed. He's 71 years old. He went back to the north of Iraq, to Mosul, because he heard the news that his son being kidnapped, and he had to go back to negotiate about the kidnapping and all. So he went back to the city. He left his wife, Rajha. I know her. She lives in Willesden, nearby. And there, after a few days, he was arrested himself. And the son apparently being arrested by the government as well. And he was accused of being giving money to Al-Qaeda, a terrorist. He is a terrorist himself and all this stuff. He'd been there since 2009. He disappeared for 4 months. No one heard about him. His wife going mad, Amnesty International acting on his behalf, and everybody looking. Anyway, he was subjected to torture, released all in a wheelchair, and 8 times he was acquitted on trial. The 9th time, they changed the judge and they sentenced him within 15 minutes to 15 years sentence. And nothing, he himself and the son. It's one of those, I mean, when you see the wife, exactly, when I was reading, I can see Rajha, the same thing, how she was really rushing from one place to another, trying to make sense of something really doesn't make sense to anyone. How on earth her husband, the quiet, the religious man, the highly moralistic person, being subjected to this, to the extent the last time she saw him, he was saying he doesn't believe anymore in anything. He's so depressed. He's more or less is like that. But I'm thinking, I mean, here we are living here in Britain and around. What kind of, I mean, the future for our children. I think you yourself, maybe you raised this question in the end, which is very important, because we're going to see generations of future young people, and if they see such system, justice system, collapsing, selective, manipulated by governments and politicians. So what a trust, and how we bring up our kids to respect these systems.
Well, it's very, very difficult. And yeah. I always find when I do university talks, you know, one of the things I have to tell myself, and I say it out loud to them, is, you know, you were in primary school when this new system started. You've been brought up to think it's normal to have Guantanamo Bay, to have people detained without trial, to have people killed by drones, to have a judiciary which is so incredibly politicized. But I want to tell you, it's non-normal. It didn't have to be like that. And I always, you know, urge them to read history and to know that we are just in a very black time. And for each of us, whether we are my age or a university student's age, we can make an individual choice to be like my friends here, which is to find a way of living that is dignified and resilient, and you convey that to your children and your grandchildren, and you live correctly. And you are not fooled by David Cameron saying what he says about, yeah, he feels about a cutada on our streets or whatever it is. You see through that. And I think that's kind of like why I hope people will read my book, because it gives you examples of people who have lived a different kind of way.
I think my final thing is the poetry. Because there are poems, and one of them is very nice, even, I mean, written by, it's in the second chapter, I think.
Okay.
And I've noticed that that's not the only one, but there were indications of others writing, and also Noor was writing in her blog. She's writing something. She lives in America, Noor, and yeah. And she wants to be a writer in the future, and she's working on it. So, and even Zaif himself,
yes.
Apparently, and he was one of the founders of Taliban. He wrote poetry, and poetry in the Arab world and the Islamic world is very important, because it is the language. It is our language. Poetry rather than novels or fiction or writing any kind of thing. So no wonder it is, whether it is oral or it is written, there is poetry always. So I wasn't surprised. So
okay,
please, if you are...
I will read a little bit of Zaniri's poem. But I want to tell you about this book, which is Poems from Guantanamo. And these poems, some of them are so heartbreaking, I can hardly bear to read them out loud. I'm not going to stop reading them now. But as Haifa says, poetry has been so important to almost all these people. And when I wrote Mirza's book with him, not only did he showed me the poems that he'd written in Guantanamo, and we put one in the front of that book. And Saba's husband, who's the most unpoetic person you could possibly imagine, she was amazed that after he'd been in Guantanamo for a few years, he started writing poetry to her. And I again, this is one of the kind of responses of resilience that I find very amazing. I'm going to read a little bit of Zaniera. The poem's called A Heart of Gold. And she wrote it on Valentine's Day. Now, Valentine's Day is the day her youngest son was born. It was also the day her husband, although she didn't know at the time, her husband was taken to Guantanamo Bay. And this is the child that, obviously, he's never seen. So always coming up to February the 14th, Zaniera has real problems with how she's going to feel on that day. But this particular year, 2012, she wrote this poem. For my beloved Shaka Ama, in 10 years of waiting, you cared for me and were ever on my side when I needed a favour. I cannot forget you, no, never. Time is new and your memory is old, but you have a heart of gold. You made my dreams come true. In my hardship, helped me through. Without you, what would I do? Your insistence cannot be sold. You have a heart of gold. You are the roof over my head. You are the shadow that can't be led. You are my voice when the silence break. Your hand I seek, your hand I hold, because you have a heart of gold. You show me light in the dark. You guide me when I'm lost. Your happiness is all I ask. Your story remains untold. You have a heart of gold. It's just so amazing, the strength that she found to write that poem. It took her a long time and a lot of revisions to get it the way she wanted it. And when you think, this is somebody, at that point she hadn't spoken to her husband in 10 years. She barely had any letters from him. He knew nothing about the texture of her life. He only knew what we all know about Guantanamo. And, you know, we used to try to shield her from knowing everything about what's happened in terms of torture and so on. And maybe we shielded her a bit, but obviously not enough.
Before I finish, I just would like to finish, if there isn't another burning question, by just reading you one paragraph from the end of my book. I think perhaps almost all the women in this book lived lives in which a harsh everyday reality and the injustice suffered in the UK or the US in these years was intertwined with memories, ghosts, and dreams of an Afghanistan or a Palestine, past or future. These other shadow lives infused everything for them, if you came close enough to listen, and were, with their faith, their secret lifeline of joy and resilience against bitterness and despair. That's my final word, and thank you very much for listening.